Well, for those of you who are visitors, we've been plodding through Job for a while, taking increasing chunks of a very difficult, very long book, but I trust finding God does speak to us and our real life situations through it. I want to read from Job chapter 11 today, and we'll be encompassing both Zophar's words here in this chapter and then Job's reply to it in 12, 13, and 14. You never heard me do four chapters in one day, did you? But we'll do our best. Job chapter 11, where Zophar, one of Job's comforting friends, deals with what he thinks are the problems that Job has to look after. Zophar the Namathite replied, "Are all these words to go unanswered? Is this talker to be vindicated? Will your idle talk reduce men to silence? Will no one rebuke you when you mock? You say to God, 'My beliefs are flawless and I am pure in your sight.' Oh, I wish that God would speak, that he would open his lips against you and disclose to you the secrets of wisdom, for true wisdom has two sides. Know this, God has even forgotten some of your sin. Can you fathom the mysteries of God? Can you probe the limits of the Almighty? They are higher than the heavens. What can you do? They are deeper than the depths of the grave. What can you know? Their measure is longer than the earth and wider than the sea. If he comes along and confines you in a prison and convenes a court, who can oppose him? Surely he recognizes deceitful men, and when he sees evil, does he not take note? But a witless man can no more become wise than a wild donkey's colt can be born a man or born tame. Yet if you divide your heart to him and or devote your heart to him and stretch out your hands to him, if you put away the sin that is in your hand and allow no evil to dwell in your tent, then you will lift up your face without shame. You will stand firm and without fear. You will surely forget your trouble, recalling it only as waters gone by. Life will be brighter than noonday, and the darkness will become like morning. You will be secure because there is hope. You will look about you and take your rest in safety. You will lie down with no one to make you afraid, and many will court your favor. But the eyes of the wicked will fail, and escape will elude them, and their hope will become a dying gasp." So he's God's word, complicated as it might be. We look to him to help us understand it and then to live it out this morning. I'm sure you've heard someone at some stage in your life described as being so heavenly minded, they're of no earthly use. It's actually a theme I've tried to battle against all through my ministry, on the basis that if someone is truly, truly heavenly minded, they will actually be the most sympathetic, down to earth, helpful, honest, real people in the whole world. Who could be more heavenly minded than Jesus himself? And yet, when that worked out in practice and daily life, there's no one more compassionate in the world than Jesus himself. However, I do understand what lies behind that accusation. There's a certain type of person, or maybe a certain kind of behavior, that sounds very spiritual, sounds very holy, sounds very Christian, but it's a kind of empty form of pious platitude. You feel the person's living in a different world, a different planet, even though they're using what sounds like good religious terminology. In fact, I think we're actually probably all guilty of it at some time or another. We've probably all said to someone as they've described a particular venture they're going on or a particular problem they're facing, well, you know, I'll be praying for you. And if someone asked us half an hour later, what have you been doing for the past half hour praying for that person, wouldn't have figured at all. It's just a phrase we tripped off the top of our lips and actually never, ever bore fruit in actual praying. It's a kind of polite way of saying cheerio if somebody's telling you a big problem and you're not sure how to handle it. Or we've exited from someone's situation of need, whispering to them very religiously, very piously, just remember, the Lord will never leave you or forsake you. Which is a powerful and wonderful truth. But what we've actually meant by saying is, I don't know what to say to you, I don't know how to handle your situation, and I want out as quick as I can, so what I'll say to cover up my embarrassment is, just remember, the Lord will never leave you or forsake you. And it can be just a pious platitude. I read Zophar's words in Job chapter 11 a bit like that. We've looked at the way in which two of his other friends had responded to Job. Eliphaz, to begin with, had based his comments to Job on the basis of personal experience. His line was, Job, in my experience, when I sin, I get punished for it. When I do good, I get blessed for it. You used to be being blessed, Job. Now you're being given a hard time, so you must have sinned, a straight line connection. And that was how Eliphaz answered from his own personal experience. Bildad, who we looked at last Sunday morning, referred back not to his personal experience, but to ancient wisdom. He said, you know what, Job, there's no person, not even a single generation of people who have enough wisdom to handle your profound problems. So you need to go back and take all the collective wisdom of the past. But when he did that, basically Bildad came back to the same conclusion. Everybody through history, Job, knows that God punishes those who do wrong and blesses those who do right. Zophar neither goes back to personal experience nor to the ancient wisdom. He's much more spiritual sounding than that. He has religious phrases to give to Job in his troubles. And so I'm going to start by thinking about those pious words, the pious advice of Zophar. He's not too long-winded, fortunately, and we can break his thoughts into bite-sized chunks quite simply. And I've put a little phrase above each of them that sums up that little passage in words that might be something that we're tempted to use piously, like a platitude from time to time. Verses 2 to 6, let the Lord speak to you. Oh, that God would speak to you. Verse 5 is actual phrase he uses, oh, I wish that God would speak. If you just took that little phrase out of its context, you might say, wow, Zophar has got to the root of the issue. Isn't that exactly how Job himself has been thinking? Job, in his previous life, when things were going fine for him, loved to converse with God. Job, when things have gone bad for him, is crying out, if only I could talk with God and hear God speak to me and explain to me what's happening to me. He's longing for God to speak. But when you read the whole paragraph, we find that Zophar isn't really thinking like that at all. He reckons, verse 3, that Job's words up until now have been idle tittle-tattle. He reckons in verse 3, Job has actually been mocking God every time he's talked about God. Verse 4, Zophar reckons Job has actually been lying in his claim to be blameless. He just didn't understand what Job was getting at. Job was not saying, I've never sinned in my whole life. Job is simply saying, my life now with God is similar, it's on the same kind of level of me seeking forgiveness, seeking mercy, seeking grace, same now as it was when things were going well for me. And that's what he couldn't add up. Zophar goes so far, verse 6, to say that Job is so sinful that God has already forgotten some of his sin. His language seems to suggest, you know, Job, you've sinned so much recently that God can't even remember it all. There's so many sins you committed. Isn't very theologically correct. God's able to remember every detail, and God is so wise to understand it. Unfortunately, so gracious, he can forgive it. So when Zophar says, I really wish God would speak to you, Job, Zophar doesn't really want God to converse with Job in a loving, tender, gracious way. He doesn't want God to speak to guide Job through these difficult days through which Job is going. Zophar is not longing for God to reveal himself and his purposes to Job, which is what Job wants. What Zophar wants when he says, I trust the Lord will speak to you, Job, is that God will give Job the telling off of his life. He's absolutely convinced that Job needs God to speak against him rather than to him. If Job has not been fazed by what Eliphaz has said, if Job hasn't paid attention to what Bildad has said, then Zophar seems to be saying, right, I want God himself to come and direct his voice straight at you and give you good telling off. That's kind of language. It sounds pious, sounds religious. Oh, that God would speak to you, Job. But actually, Zophar has decided in his mind exactly what God would say to Job if God started speaking to Job. And it's not what Job wants. More importantly, it's not what God wants. Second section, verses 7 to 9 of this chapter, I've titled, Believe in God's Greatness. So here's Zophar, first little pious thought, Job, let God speak to you. Second pious thought, Job, just believe in God's greatness, verses 7 to 9. I'm sure that lots of us have read the book that J.B. Phillips wrote, it must be 50 plus years ago, Your God is Too Small. If you've never read it, well worth buying, because it reminds us that our default mode as human beings is to bring God down to our level, maybe just slightly bigger than us, slightly wiser than us, slightly more loving than us, but only kind of Superman level above us, not off the scale altogether. And what Zophar seems to be saying, first of all, is, you know what, Job? God is off our scale of greatness. And oh, that you would believe in God's greatness and understand how wonderful it is. Unfortunately, Zophar, even then, has actually got another underlying agenda. He does speak about how great God is, how wonderful God is in nature, and how great God is in creation, and how marvelous the wisdom of God is. But he's not saying this actually so that Job might be uplifted by a sense of the greatness of God. He's not really saying, you know what, Job, God's so big that he has a plan, a good plan for you that encompasses all this bad stuff that's been happening to you. Zophar is not actually saying to Job, I believe God is big enough to overrule all this for his glory. He has no message for Job about the greatness of God's love. The word doesn't appear in Zophar's language here. No message about God's amazing grace and mercy. Never uses those words in this passage. Nothing about the greatness of God's tender loving kindness. Doesn't seem to focus Zophar at all. All that Zophar is saying is actually trying to add to his already handed out agenda, and you see it in verse 8. What can you do? What can you know? So part of him saying, you know, look at God's greatness, look at God's wisdom, look at God's immensity in creation, in history, in our lives, as though to say, you know, let that sense of God's greatness lift you out of your troubles and burdens. But actually, that's not what his real intention is at all. His real intention is, Job, get a sight of God's greatness and just remember how tiny and miserable of a worm you are. Is a big put down at the end of the day. It's not intent to lift Job up, it's intent to squash him underneath his heavy-handed feet. Like his companion Zophar is still buying into the philosophy that all suffering is a direct punishment for our individual sin. The third little phrase that I put together, covering verses 10 through to 20, is put your hope in the Lord. These are quite difficult verses to translate, and if you have a way of comparing versions at home on online or with a number of different versions, you'll find it all translated slightly differently, very difficult to interpret. But Zophar seems to be assuring Job that actually Job is not altogether evil and wicked. If you take the whole section from verses 10 to 20, first section seems to be talking about really wicked and evil people. The last verse seems to be talking about really wicked people. But in between, he's talking about Job. As though Job isn't quite as bad as the real, real wicked people, there is some hope for him. So in verses 10 to 12, Zophar is talking about the witless, the deceitful, the evil people who have no more chance of becoming wise than a wild donkey's colt can be born tame, which is quite amusing when you think about it. I think become tame rather than be a man. What he's saying is if a donkey has a colt born to it and the donkey is a wild donkey, then inevitably and forever that colt born to it will be wild. And he's saying in the world of wickedness and evil, those who are born wicked and those who are born evil are bound to be evil, and there's absolutely no hope for them. Let's stop there and say that's not true. He got that wrong. The wonderful grace of our God says no matter how much a person has messed up in life, no matter what they've done, the death of Jesus Christ on the cross can cancel that sin debt and set that person free and purge their conscience and give them liberty of the children of God. So if you're here this morning, not a Christian, you think, well, I wouldn't mind being a Christian. I wouldn't mind enjoying this freedom, forgiveness, and liberty, but I've got a history. I've got a wardrobe full of skeletons at home. Thank God today, believe with all your heart, he's a God who's big enough to take all that sin and wipe it out forever. That's the Christian gospel. So far I got that wrong, actually, that the wild donkey's colt may not be born tame, but it can be made tame by God. In verse 20, he says the wicked have no real hope at all. And he's actually right there as well. Those who die without faith in God, without trust in God, without a relationship to God, do have no ultimate hope. I think it's worth thinking through that briefly. For we live in a world where folks will reject God, put God on the periphery of life year after year after year after year. They have no time for him. They have no thought for him. They're not even sure he exists. I certainly don't think he matters. And then suddenly the doctor gives them some serious report of illness and suddenly start thinking, well, maybe there is a God there and, he's bound to let me in at the end of the day. Those who die without faith, without trust, without a personal relationship to God have no real hope at all. Zophar was right on that. In between those two sections, verses 13 to 19, Zophar's speaking to Job a bit differently. So verse 18, there is hope for Job. Verse 16, there is a prospect for a future in which all those bad days can be forgotten. Verse 17, much better days can be ahead for Job. Life will be brighter than noonday and darkness will become like morning. This is Zophar talking this way to Job. He's already given him some pious thoughts. Now he's saying, well, you know what, Job? The wicked can't be changed. There is no hope for the wicked. But you... there is hope for you. There is a better day ahead for you. Your future could be as bright as a noonday. Sounds great, doesn't it? You think, well, at last, so far, it's got some positivity for poor Job. But again, we have to say it's sadly the pious words that can't hide Zophar's underlying conviction about why Job is suffering. And if you look at verses 13 and 14, you see it there. This hope, as far as Zophar is concerned, is dependent upon Job. Sort out your devotion to God, sort out your prayers, stretching out your hand to God, sort out your own sin, sort out your family sin, the sin in the tent. And if you get all that sorted, Job, then you'll have hope. Then everything will be hunky-dory. Then it'll be like the bright noonday. So his bottom line, behind that very, very pious note, there's hope for you, Job, is actually a very negative thing, still blaming Job for Job's troubles. But worse than that, he's actually going along Satan's agenda as well. What he's saying to Job is, you know what, Job? You need to sort out your devotion, your worship, your praise, your spiritual life. Get it all sorted. And if you get it all sorted, then God will be good to you. Here's a reason to sort your life out. Here's a reason to worship God. Here's a reason to praise God. Here's a reason to sort out the family life. It's so then God will be good to you. If you hear right at the start, we said that's what underlies the whole of this book. Satan accused God of only getting people to worship him by being good to them. Job only loves you because you're good, not because you're God. The big test all the way through the book is, would Job get that into his thinking? When God took all the good stuff out of his life, would Job start saying, oh, well, I can't be bothered with that kind of God. He's not being so good to me at the minute. I only want a God who does good stuff for me. Zophar has that kind of mentality. Start worshiping God, start praising God, start serving God, da-da-da-da-da, and then God will be good to you. Thankfully, as we'll see, Job didn't buy into that. And Job's attitude that comes out very stark in this next little bit is, no matter how bad the stuff of life is for me, I'm going to continue to trust God. Don't ever let the devil tempt you to believe that trusting God just makes everything perfect. Trusting God is to do with how good God is, a God to be worshipped, loved, and trusted because of who he is, not, of course, what he gives to us as his children. The pious advice of Zophar then seemed to have things in it that sounded religious, sounded spiritual, even sounded caring. But actually, the bottom line was Zophar, just like his mates, was saying, Job, you're suffering because you sinned, and if you stop sinning, God will be good to you. And it's too simplistic an approach to life, and one that Job himself doesn't take on board. So let me take you, secondly, in terms of main headings today, to the developing wisdom of Job. And as I've indicated already, Job's replies get longer and longer. It's quite interesting that the friends get shorter and shorter, and Job gets longer and longer. And so this next reply of Job covers the whole of chapters 12, 13, and 14. And I'm not going to go verse by verse through them today with you. But let me pick out some of the important tracks of thought here. I have to say, first of all, that some of what Job said as he starts to talk wasn't actually very nice. It was a bit sarcastic. So in 12, verse 2, he says to his friend Zophar, doubtless you are the people and wisdom will die with you. A bit sarky, but I think he's been goaded, hasn't he? Or chapter 13 and verse 4, you are worthless physicians, all of you. And you think of him sitting on the heap outside the city wall, the boils, the physical problems he's suffering, And his friends actually hadn't come as doctors. But he's saying, actually, you're like physicians, you're like doctors who come, but you're worthless. 13 verse 5, if only you would be altogether silent, for you, that would be wisdom. I think that's fascinating. Here's a chapter that deals with wisdom, and here are his friends trying to be wise advisors and saying, you know what, boys, if you shut your mouths, that would be the wisest thing you've ever done with me. A bit sarky. But I think Job saw through Zophar's pious-sounding advice. Look at chapter 13, verse 12. Your maxims are proverbs of ashes, and your defenses are defenses of clay. He's saying you're producing these maxims, these proverbs, these sayings. But actually, it's like the dust that's left when you finish your barbecue is worthless. I think Job is accurate in what he says, but I think a bit unspiritual in his criticism. When you are going through a hard time, and when folks do come off with the pious phrases, and you are annoyed at them, don't take it out on them. Just recognize we all do it. We're all struggling to know what to say to people in their dark moments. Just recognize that even if you get the most brilliant way of epitomizing exactly what's happening to that person and the perfect answer, it won't necessarily sound right to them. As we said right at the start, sometimes the best thing to do is just sit beside those who are going through tough times and let them know you care. For our words so often are inadequate. Much of the rest of Job's comments display a growing wisdom. As I thought about that during the week, I thought, is that maybe why this book is so long? And why his friends were with him so long, and why the process between the first loss and the final restoration is such a long period of time, because there was a process going on here of Job developing his understanding of God and developing his wisdom about God. Here's what I'm suggesting in chapters 13, 14. He worships an all-wise God. So in chapter 12, in chapter 13, 7 and 10, there is wisdom to be learned from nature. And he talks just like Bildad had done about the things we can learn by looking at how God has worked in his creation. In verse 12, there is wisdom to be found in the ancients. Sorry, 12, verse 12, that is. Remember that again was what Bildad had said. You'll go back to the ancients. He said, yeah, there is wisdom to be found there. But 12, verse 13, all this wisdom comes from God himself. And now in chapter 12, verses 14 to 25, he delves, I think, more deeply into that and how God's wisdom operates. So what he does, he lists lots of illustrations from everyday life. Illustrations that show that God does have wisdom, God does have power, and does things with that wisdom and power that we cannot explain. And that's a key thought. God in wisdom and power does things that we can't explain. So verse 15, drought and flood. There's hardly a month goes by on a television screen, but some part of the world has been shown up either in the grip of devastating, death-producing drought or of devastating, death-producing flood. And sometimes in the one country, just a few weeks or months apart. Now you're saying, if God is all wise and God is all good, and Zophar and his mates believe that, then this immense wisdom of God has to incorporate both the drought and the flood in the same place. Verse 22, God is a God who reveals deep things of darkness. Coming to the New Testament, how often we find Jesus himself, the light of the world, his disciples, the light of the world, God who manifests, God who reveals, God who shows light in the darkness. It's a brilliant theme. But Job's pondering, the same God who reveals things that are dark is a God who brings shadows to block out the light at times. The same God who caused the sun to rise in the morning caused it to set at night. The people who love the sun rising and say, isn't this brilliant? God's great. He's set the sun to shine on another day for us. Maybe have a problem when night falls and the sun goes and the darkness descends. But it's the same God, this is Job's point, same God who does both. As we were saying with the kiddies last week, the same God who brings the rain on holiday time on Queen's Jubilee Day is the same God who makes the sun to shine on a different day. We might say, oh, a good day is a bright, sunny, dry, warm day, and a bad day is a wet, cold, miserable day. But God in his great wisdom and his great power brings both. He knows what he's doing. There's no human being can say, I have such a perfect understanding of meteorology and such a perfect understanding of all the weather systems that I know exactly what this part of this continent at this point in time needs by way of rain or sunshine. You as a holiday maker, those on holiday might know exactly what you think should come. But God's the only one without wisdom. And that's the point Job's making. Job is worshipping God as the wise one, even though he doesn't understand what God was doing at that point in time or why. Job is worshipping the wise God, even though God was not doing good things for Job at that point in his life. And often I think a great challenge of the book of Job to all of us who profess to be Christians is, am I prepared to worship God not just when the blessings are pouring out of heaven like a thunderstorm, but am I prepared to worship God as God when life has reached its most difficult and trying moment? And here's a book that says God is worth worshiping in the worst time, not just in the good times. So he worships the all-wise God. Secondly, he trusts the all-wise God. Here's this great phrase in chapter 13, verse 15. Though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. I will surely defend my ways to his face. He doesn't trust his all-wise friends. Chapter 13, verse 4, you smear me with lies. Not very complimentary, but he's actually honest. His friends have been telling him a pack of lies, not intentionally. They've used the wisdom of the ancients. They've used their own experience. They used some trite phrases, but actually what they've been saying to him was not the truth. But he's absolutely convinced that God himself can be trusted. Job is saying that if God did nothing good for him for the rest of his life, and then brought about his death, Job would still have his hope in God. That's the only kind of God worth knowing, isn't it? If your trust is in somebody or something that isn't a life and death matter to you, it's not for real. All Job wanted was to stand before God and hear God's reasons for what has been happening. Job is neither critical of God's decisions nor dismissive of them. He's just curious to understand them. He worships the all-wise God. He trusts that all-wise God. And in closing, he anticipates meeting that all-wise God. Here we're into chapter 14 in verses 14 through to 17. As though Job is beginning to realize that he might not get answers in the here and now. Up at this point in the book, you sense Job has been saying, Lord, just speak to me. Just say something now. Just explain to me. Just tell me why this has happened. All my family have gone except my wife. All my possessions have gone. All my livestock's gone. My own health is gone. I don't know why. As far as I know, Lord, I've been as close to you as ever I have been in my whole life up to this point in time. I don't understand why. All I want, Lord, is for you to speak to me here and now and tell me why. It seems that at this point in time, suddenly it clicks with Job. Zophar, in a sense, has prodded into this. He's talked about a hope for the future. As suddenly as though Job says, yeah, Lord, I understand. I might not get the answer here and now. But I will in my flesh stand before God. Chapter 14 is an odd chapter. The first few verses seem to suggest that mankind is just like the flower that dies and is no more after it, like the mountain that corrodes away, like the sea taking away the sand on the shore so it doesn't exist anymore. Sometimes mankind is like a riverbed that becomes parched and dies away. And so part of what Job seems to say is, well, there isn't any hope beyond. But then comes this wonderful theme in the middle. Like last week, he hinted there was a mediator, a go-between. So now, it's so there is life after death. He will be renewed. He will be revived. And he will stand before God. And he will plead his case. And God will answer and explain. Not in this life, but in the life to come. And as he grapples with that thought, I think Job provides us with one of the great Christian consolations. We have an all-wise, all-powerful God who does things we cannot understand in this life. Part of us says, please, Lord, tell me why. And sometimes he does. And sometimes he says, I can't explain it to you just now. You're not capable of understanding. But one day you'll stand before me. One day you'll be in my presence. One day you'll hear me speak to you face to face. And face to face we'll behold him, we will see him, and we'll know him, and we'll understand what just couldn't be comprehended in this life at all. I'm not sure how far Job got that day in grasping that fully. But I think God was very gracious to him and pointed Job out of Zophar's attitude, just do the good stuff now and you'll have a bright tomorrow. And God pointed him to at the end of life, there's something far greater. That's not just the truth. It's not just a platitude. That's real wisdom. To expect to stand before God and talk to him face to face. Is that your hope? Is that your assurance, your confidence?